worth its electric sockets, offered most of the biggies, the games just about every kid knew and loved. Space Invaders, Pac-Man, Ms. Pac-Man, Donkey Kong, and Asteroids. All of these titles sold more than 100,000 units in the United States, and represented the true elite class of arcade video games. I could pick these games out quickly because they were always surrounded by clumps of onlookers hoping to get tips and learn patterns from watching high-scoring players. What's more, these games would always have a long row of gleaming quarters sitting on the bottom frame of their title panels. It was a sort of reservation system for waiting players, who put quarters up to mark their spot in line. Of course, the coins weren't marked, and there were always squabbles over whose quarter belonged to whom. In the end, bigger and tougher kids just pushed the rest aside and took their turns as they pleased anyway. I didn't like to wait to play games, and as a smallish kid who valued his teeth, I tried to avoid confrontations, especially with acne-scarred teenagers wearing Motorhead t-shirts. So I gravitated to the next tier of games, the ones that were still a blast to play but didn't attract crowds. Centipede, Defender, Galaxian, Missile Command, Tempest, Dig Dug, and for my money, the best racing game ever, Pole Position. If I spotted two or three of these titles, I'd deem it a quality game room and look forward to my later return. There were also certain rare titles that really got me excited. If I spotted any of these games, I'd pull out all the stops in negotiations with my mother to secure as many quarters as possible. These titles barely registered a blip on the virtual radar of casual gamers, but video game connoisseurs like me savored them. These rare finds included GORF, short for Galactic Orbiting Robot Force, Rip-Off, Battle Zone, and my all-time underrated favorite, Burger Time. Burger Time was a game with an unusual premise, even in the weird and wacky world of video games. The player assumed the role of a character named Peter Pepper, a fast-food fry cook tasked with assembling four hamburgers simultaneously. The tiny chef had to scurry up and down ladders to reach multiple layers of oversized ingredients, bun, burger patty, lettuce, tomato, and others. By running across each one, he squashed them down to lower levels, and ultimately, a plate. Apparently, Mr. Pepper's food preparation methods weren't scrutinized by any tiny pixelated inspectors from any health department. Adding more absurdity to the proceedings were three foes, a hot dog, a pickle, and a fried egg, each sporting a pair of spry little legs, that chased the tiny chef all over the screen, inexplicably trying to prevent him from making the burgers. Perhaps they were militant vegans. With games like these available, it was beyond me why anyone would wait in line just to drift around space shooting at rocks. Not that I had much time to contemplate the matter. After I completed my quick scout of the game room, I had to hustle back to the lobby. There was still work to be done before I'd be permitted time for play, and I had to earn my quarters. Transporting our belongings from the car to our hotel room was an undertaking in itself. After regrouping in the lobby from our scouting missions, Dad would march us all back out to our car. There, my mom would wisely exclude herself from the proceedings to clear out the day's trash from the car's interior. Dad would load us up one by one with suitcases, gym bags, pillows, blankets, and other items until our belongings were piled so high on our arms that we couldn't see. When the trunk was empty, we'd begin the perilous trek to our room. Following one after another in a line, we'd stumble ahead, while my father shouted directions to the leader from the rear. If whoever was leading us unexpectedly bashed into a wall, or tripped over a bench, or encountered some other obstruction, say, another hotel guest, we'd all squash into the back of the person ahead of us like an accordion being squeezed. To any bystander observing us, we looked like an expedition of drunken Sherpas. Of course, we could have made it all easier by dividing our load into two trips, but that wasn't my father's way. In his mind, two trips would take twice as long. Even on the short journey from our car to the room, Dad was intent on making good time. When our human baggage train arrived at our room, Dad would unlock the door and we'd lug our belongings inside. Because we mostly stayed at one of the major chains, our rooms were typically clean and reasonably spacious. for a typical family of four. My family, of course, had six members, not to mention the extra baggage that came along. This made our accommodations considerably more snug. Our rooms usually provided two modestly sized double beds, so the question naturally arose of where two of us would sleep. This was never good news for the two of us with the least tenure in my family, my sister and me. The answer would come with a knock on the door. Upon its opening, a hotel employee would wheel inside two rickety rollaway beds that my dad ordered at check-in, no doubt negotiated into our room fee at no extra charge. Dad would direct the employee to push the rollaways inside our room and up against the wall of the narrow entry hallway. This placement would leave just enough space for us to pass through, so long as we exhaled all the air from our lungs. The beds would remain there, folded up, until we returned from dinner or a visit to the pool, or a game room, and had washed up for bed. By this time, the room began to take on the claustrophobic feel of, say, a collapsed mine shaft. It would only get worse. Once we settled in, my father would finally allow himself to relax. For him, this meant slipping off his shoes and sipping a cocktail. Of course, he'd never pay the outrageous prices being charged down at the hotel bar. What? $3 for a Manhattan? The actual Manhattan costs less. So my dad always brought his own solution. He called it the medicine kit. Sears department store called it the executive portable travel bar. Outwardly, the travel bar looked no different from a small suitcase with a handle and key lock on one side. But my father treated it with a kind of reverence not afforded any of our other belongings. The first thing that made the case special was that it was with us at all. Keep in mind, we were a family of six traveling in a car, albeit a large luxury model, packed with luggage for a 7 to 10 day trip. To ensure we had enough space for everything, my parents restricted the number of pairs of underwear we could pack. But there was never a question of there being enough room for Dad's cocktail kit. Inside our room, Dad would clear off a section of table and gently stand the case on end, indicating the magical moment had arrived. I'd always look on with intense interest. Dad would reach into his pocket and produce a thin brass key pinched between his thumb and forefinger. He'd lift it up in front of his eyes, where it beamed in the glow of the room's TV screen. Then he'd insert the key into the lock and twist it. Like an archaeologist opening a miniature sarcophagus for the first time in centuries, he'd carefully part the two halves of the case, exposing its contents. On one side gleamed silver tumblers, ornate tools, and an intricately etched serving tray. On the other side were three full-size liquor bottles tucked side by side into a cushion of lustrous red velveteen, each held in place with its own leather strap. To my youthful eyes, the setup resembled something fashioned for James Bond by Q back at the spy lab. An entire bar shrunk down and housed in a small box disguised as an ordinary suitcase. Cool. While my father removed the contents, I'd immediately grab the plastic ice bucket and head off in search of the nearest ice machine. My dad had trained me well. I'd do this without even being asked, and it was a job in which I took great pride. It was like getting to play a role in some sacred adult ritual. Plus, it was always fun to explore the hallways of a hotel unsupervised. But there was no time to dally. I knew that once Dad was in cocktail mode, the clock was ticking. So I tried to hustle back with his ice as quickly as possible. As I handed over the bucket, Dad would thank me with a wink and proceed with his alchemy. Using shimmering tongs, he'd plunk a few cubes into two glasses, one bearing his initials etched on the side and another for my mom. Then he'd use the jigger to meticulously measure out the portions for two separate cocktails, a scotch and soda for mom and a brandy Manhattan for himself. Dad could have dispensed the perfect amounts with his eyes closed, of course, but that would have made his ridiculously well-equipped executive travel bar a bit less essential. And what would be the fun in that? After both cocktails were prepared, Dad would hand Mom hers. Then they'd clink their glasses to toast the close of another long day on the road. It was a moment of great excitement for all of us, After all, once Mom and Dad were diving into their liquid refreshment, we could do the same. The kind waiting for us down at the pool. After changing into our swimsuits and squeezing through the harrowing passage of rollaway beds, we made our way through the maze of corridors to the hotel pool. If tables were available, we'd claim one located near the shallow area of the pool so Mom could keep an eye on us. More specifically, me. While she and Dad sipped their cocktails. Meanwhile, I'd make my way into the pool to test the water temperature for everyone else, usually after an unexpected push by one of my brothers. While playing in the pool, I'd keep a close eye on the clock so I'd know when it was time to leave for the game room. My parents would always set a time when we were all required to regroup and return to our room. I didn't want to cheat myself out of time for an extra game, but I didn't want to get gypped out of pool time either. Around 10 p.m., we'd reunite as planned and return to our room to get ready for bed. For us kids, this meant putting on pajamas and brushing our teeth. For my parents, it meant converting our modest hotel room into a scene resembling a Red Cross refugee camp. While my brothers and I were in the bathroom fighting for a spot at the sink, Dad would push the large folded rollaway beds out of the room's hallway and into the main room. He'd flop one open, then the other, each releasing its own plume of dust gathered from sitting in some musty closet probably since my family's last stay. With both beds opened, not an inch of floor space remained, transforming the room into one gigantic mattress. However, the rollaway beds always sat at a higher level than the room's conventional beds. This meant that if anyone got up during the night to use the bathroom, they'd have to navigate a perilous obstacle course. Not only would you have to clamber from one mattress to the next in complete darkness, trying to avoid any stray limbs or foot-swallowing crevices between mattresses, you also had to be careful not to bang into the elevated sharp metal frames of the rollaway beds. If you did, it would take all your willpower to stifle your screams as throbbing pain erupted from your shin, so you didn't wake everyone else. You weren't much safer sleeping. Your chances of being roused from slumber by a bare foot stepping on your face were always dangerously high. Of course, before the lights ever went out, the whole setup practically begged for a pillow fight, much to my mom's aggravation. They'd usually start playfully enough, with my sister and me tossing stuffed animals at each other over some mild gripe. One of us would miss and hit one of our brothers. Okay, sometimes on purpose. And the real brawl would begin. In a blink, a small skirmish would escalate to a spirited clash, then a heated fracas. Before long, my parents would have an all-out Donnybrook on their hands. As grizzled veterans of many previous fights, most notoriously the Battle of the Birmingham Best Western of 74, we all knew the key to victory was being the first to grab one of the pillows we had brought from home to use as a weapon. These pillows were stuffed with hefty goose down and packed a mighty wallop when swung full force. Hotel pillows were usually foam and far too light to deliver anything but a trifling swipe. When forced to defend myself with one of those, my only real shot at survival was to hold the pillow with both arms extended straight out and blindly charge my attacker. As the youngest, I never had much of a chance anyway. These fights would inevitably end with one of my brothers on top of me, pinning my arms under his knees while mercilessly jabbing his index fingers into the ticklish spots above my kidneys. By that time of evening, my parents were usually too exhausted to make any real effort to break up the conflicts beyond offering a perfunctory, "You kids better stop that or someone will get hurt." It was usually only a matter of time until we proved them right. My sister would knock her head against one of the metal rollaway bed frames, or my brother would get his eyeglasses bashed into the bridge of his nose. Or, most often, I'd wind up in a crumpled heap after plummeting headfirst into one of the treacherous fissures in our mattresscape. At that point, Mom would remind us that we needed to get to sleep before we'd all face an even greater threat. My father's legendary snoring. As the years passed, Mom eventually convinced Dad to begin paying for two adjoining motel rooms. The constant disputes between six family members fighting over the use of one hotel bathroom had taken their toll on her. and as the size of both our car's interior and our hotel rooms began to shrink in direct proportion to the growth of us four kids, even my dad conceded it was worth the extra money to put a wall between himself and the loudest and smelliest of his clan. So my sister stayed with my parents in one room, where they enjoyed a little more peace and room to spread out, and my brothers and I were banished to our own room next door, where we were free to fight and fart as we pleased. Still, as much as my brothers and I enjoyed our private space and freedom, I couldn't help but miss the experience of my whole family spending evenings together in a single room. The musty smell and constant squeaks of those wobbly rollaway beds, the relentless jokes my brothers and I would make about Dad's skinny chicken legs, and the condition of his saggy, moth-eaten briefs that would be revealed as he undressed for bed, the way we'd keep talking to each other in the darkness after the lights were switched off, about what we planned to do the following day, waking to the muffled curses of my father as he'd knock about blindly trying to find his way for the bathroom for his 2 a.m. tinkle, and, of course, those epic nightly pillow fights. Sure, it was crazy. But after all, we were six people locked up together in a tiny padded room. Chapter 9. Heavy Metal Highways. Land yachts, station wagons, and the thing. The practice of American companies testing employees for drug use didn't become widespread until the mid-80s, at the prodding of the Reagan administration. I mention this in passing only as one possible explanation for automobile design in the 70s. How else to explain the bizarre AMC Pacer? A car whose design appeared to be based on the scrubbing bubbles of TV ad fame, or the Chevy El Camino, a vehicle that looked like a pickup truck had smashed into the back of a sports coupe. And it wasn't just American car designers who were coming up with questionable vehicle concepts at the time. Somehow, German Volkswagen engineers decided that a vehicle combining the off-road performance of a California dune buggy with the style of a Nazi staff car would be a good idea. They called it the thing. It lasted 2 years. At the same time, the normally sophisticated French defiled America's shores with their own abomination, a super mini compact from Renault called Le Car. It was as hard on the eyes as it was easy on the gas budget, which in fairness was its purpose. The Le Car was so easy its owners checked to make sure no one was looking before slinking into the driver's seat. Meanwhile, engineers at Datsun and Toyota released one oddity after another. Among these was Japan's version of the El Camino, the Subaru Brat, a dubious acronym for Bi-Drive Recreational All-Terrain Transporter. The Brat's most distinguishing feature was a pair of rear-facing jump seats in its uncovered cargo bed, apparently included to dissuade any friends of Brat owners from asking for rides to the airport. It was as if automobile designers of the day weren't even really trying. Consider the origins of the AMC Gremlin, one of the most derided cars of the era. Richard A. Teague, head of AMC Design, admitted he sketched his initial idea for the car on an airsickness bag while on a flight. The Gremlin made its debut on April 1st, 1970. Yep, April Fool's Day. The crazy thing isn't that these cars were ever designed. It's that they were actually produced, in large numbers, by major car companies. Somehow, at no point in the approval process for the Pacer, did anyone at AMC say, "You know, I'm not sure the world is ready for a car that looks like an underwater base for sea monkeys." But the highways of the era were made all the more interesting for it. With so many weird and wonderful vehicles being produced in the 70s, there was never a better time to be traveling. While the role that recreational pharmaceuticals played in 70s car design may be debatable, there's no arguing the impact of two key influences. The first was the U.S. government's introduction of harsh vehicle emission standards in 1972. The other was the country's first major oil crisis. As air pollution became an increasing concern in the 1950s and 1960s, particularly in urban areas, studies were conducted to identify its cause. Unsurprisingly, research pointed to America's growing number of automobiles. but evidence of air pollution's harmful impact outside traffic-jammed cities did catch people's attention. Suddenly, air pollution wasn't just a local issue. It was a national problem, one that required a national agency to address it. In 1970, the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, was established to alleviate the impact of pollution. In short order, the EPA imposed emission standards for all new vehicles sold in the United States. Automobile manufacturers responded by implementing a variety of re-burning strategies that made engines less powerful. As a result, in the midst of a fuel crisis, America began producing cars that, over a given span, consumed more gasoline. By 1975, the EPA's tightening standards all but mandated that every new vehicle be equipped with a catalytic converter. The devices did reduce the pollutants expelled by automobiles, but they weren't compatible with engines using regular leaded gas. This set off a mad scramble by oil companies to make sufficient unleaded gasoline available in time for the release of 1975 car models. The introduction of catalytic converters as part of a national effort to reduce the amount of lead in our environment is why we exclusively use unleaded fuel in vehicles today. Higher emission standards and catalytic converters all but strangled engine performance, and cars designed for speed and power. Because there wasn't much point in producing muscle cars without muscle, car companies simply stopped making them. By 1975, many of the macho cars that had become synonymous with American horsepower, the Plymouth Barracuda, Chevy Chevelle Supersport, and Dodge Charger RT, among others, were put out to pasture. Other models atrophied into unrecognizable versions of their former selves. The venerable Ford Mustang, the car that had long set the standard for power and style, was reintroduced in 1974 as the Ford Mustang II. Built on the same subcompact size platform as the Ford Pinto, the Mustang II's standard engine wheezed out just 88 horsepower. Luxury cars and family station wagons were hit by the new regulations as well. While some models remained large, my family's 1972 Ford LTD Country Squire station wagon stretched nearly 19 feet, many were almost hilariously underpowered. The engine laboring to push our portly 4,500-pound station wagon produced just 200 horsepower. Loaded with six passengers and luggage, the car struggled to break the minimum highway speed limit. The country's first major oil shortage also reshaped how cars were designed. In retaliation for America's support of Israel during the Yom Kippur War, OPEC in 1973 announced it would cut oil production by 25%, prompting the Nixon administration to develop a response plan. To ensure the reduced fuel supply would be distributed fairly, the government decreed that each state would be allocated the same proportion of the nation's total fuel use it had consumed the previous year. Knowing that shortages would mean skyrocketing fuel prices, Nixon also imposed limits on how much gas stations could charge. But the government could only do so much. When rationing became necessary, only motorists with even-numbered license plates were allowed to purchase gas one day, while those with odd-numbered plates could drive up to the pump the next day. Fearing stations would run out of gas, nervous drivers filled their tanks at every opportunity, forming long lines at the pumps. While waiting, drivers kept cars idling, fearing another driver might cut in if they didn't pull ahead fast enough, behavior that needlessly burned more gas and compounded the shortages, of course. Eventually, some gas stations did run dry. According to AAA, 20% of the nation's gas stations had no fuel to sell during the final week of February 1974. For the first time, Americans realized just how dependent they were on foreign nations for their fuel, and they were shocked. What followed was a rush to trading gas guzzlers for smaller, more fuel-efficient vehicles. Sales of the AMC Gremlin, Ford Pinto, and Chevy Vega soared. Buyers also flocked to economical models manufactured overseas. Many imports came equipped with air conditioning, power steering, AM/FM radios, and other features for which domestic manufacturers charged extra. Buyers also noticed the cars seemed to be built better than similar American cars, and several were earning outstanding reputations for reliability. Among these models were the Toyota Corona, the Datsun 510, the Subaru DL, and later the Honda Accord. Detroit's long stranglehold on the automobile market was beginning to slip. Perhaps nothing symbolized this transition more than an event in 1972. Early that year, Volkswagen Beetle number 15,007,034 rolled off the assembly line, surpassing the Ford Model T as the best-selling car in automotive history. The automobile Henry Ford II once dismissed as a little shitbox went on to sell more than 21 million units and remained a top seller for decades. America's first fuel crisis lasted less than a year. But Americans' desire for smaller, more economical cars continued. As a result of the dramatic changes, the highways of the 70s were filled with a menagerie of odd and interesting vehicles not seen before or since. There were enormous land yachts and tiny subcompacts, overpowered muscle cars and underpowered family sedans. Station wagons with fake wood side panels and luxury cars with phony convertible tops. Cars that aspired to be pickups and trucks that yearned to be dune buggies. Tricked out custom vans with wide murals and stripped down minibuses that appeared to be built for people in the witness protection program. Two-tone color patterns, thick racing stripes, and metal chip-flaked paint ruled the day. It was a weird and wonderful time to be out on the roads, especially as a kid in the backseat of a car on a long road trip with nothing better to do than take it all in. It was easy to get a good look at cars because in the 70s, so many could be seen stalled at the side of the highways. It was not a proud period of quality for the auto industry. Although foreign car makers weren't immune to quality issues, Detroit's Big Three made regular headlines with one massive recall after another. Part of the problem was that the industry was struggling with the transition to a new generation of assembly line workers. In 1970, fully one-third of the line workers at America's three major automakers were younger than 30 years old. Having come of age during the free-thinking 60s, many of these workers deplored the monotony and onerous demands that came with life on the assembly line, conditions their parents had readily accepted. When in 1970 General Motors suspended two United Auto Workers, UAW, union leaders for balking in an order to speed up production, hundreds of workers abruptly walked off the line. Workers also found other ways to demonstrate their unhappiness. David Frum summarized the situation in his book, How We Got Here, The 70s. The discontent on the line expressed itself not in protest but in spontaneous acts of sabotage. One quarter of Ford's assembly line workers quit in 1970. Unexcused absences from work doubled at Ford and General Motors between 1961 and 1970, spiking upward most sharply in 1969 to 70. In the spring of 1970, 5% of General Motors workers were missing without excuse on any given day. On Fridays and Mondays, up to 10% of the workforce failed to show up. Even when workers did show up, management may have often wished they hadn't. According to Frum, disgruntled workers took to vandalizing cars, especially the expensive models. Fortune reported that screws have been left in brake drums, tool handles welded into fender compartments to cause mysterious, unfindable, and eternal rattles, paint scratched and upholstery cut. Resentful employees weren't the only ones to blame for Detroit's quality issues in the 70s. Poor engineering, penny-pinching by management, and questionable decisions by top executives also factored in. By 1977, Detroit was recalling nearly as many cars as it sold. According to some automobile industry historians, cars that rolled off American assembly lines at the time had, on average, 7 significant defects. It was a bad time for motorists to have to count on their automobiles. especially those who are planning on traveling a long way from home. Because American automobile quality was so poor in the 70s, the potential for a breakdown on a road trip was more a probability than a possibility. Like many other motorists, my father belonged to AAA, in large part for the club's roadside assistance program. But in order to call AAA for help, he first had to get to a phone. That wasn't always easy after breaking down on a lonely stretch of interstate between, say, Memphis and Mobile. Not only were there fewer exits with service stations back then, there were fewer motorists traveling the highways who might offer stranded drivers a lift. In the days before cell phones, motorists who ran into mechanical problems on the highways were largely on their own. For this reason, my father took every precaution before we set out on a lengthy road trip. Days before our departure, he'd take the car into a dealership for a thorough inspection and oil change. Then he'd head over to Kmart to pick up all the appropriate spare fuses, bulbs, and belts for our car. Finally, he'd scramble about our garage, filling a tool bag with assorted wrenches and ratchets and scooping up giant jugs of coolant and cans of gloopy lubricants. After packing the trunk with our luggage, he'd fill every remaining crevice with the items he had collected. He didn't know how to use many of these tools and supplies, mind you. My father wasn't particularly mechanically inclined, at least when it came to automobiles. But he was smart enough to sire a son who was. By the time he was a teenager, my brother Bruce was already a seasoned wrench. From the moment he handled his first Matchbox racer, Bruce fell in love with cars. He read magazines like Road and Track and Motor Trend cover to cover. He took every automotive shop class offered in junior high and high school. He'd have his head under a hood at every opportunity. And so my family's fate out on the highways often hinged on the automotive acumen of a kid who wasn't even old enough to drive. On a number of occasions when some mechanical malady or distressing din forced us off the road, Bruce could always devise a solution. When a pinhole erupted in the radiator of our 75 Lincoln Town Car halfway to Florida, it was Bruce who knew of an obscure sealant that could save the day. We found the product at a nearby hardware store and continued on our way. When a blazing sun caused our 77 Oldsmobile Regency to overheat on a remote Alabama highway, it was Bruce who suggested that my dad crank the heater to vent the engine. As crazy as it seemed to crawl along a baking highway in a vehicle with a steaming engine and our heater on full blast, we made it to an exit and help. When the exhaust system of our 78 Cadillac sedan DeVille became unfastened and began spraying sparks across the highway, it was Bruce who used a couple of wire clothes hangers from Mom's suitcase to secure it back into place. On other occasions, he fixed flats, adjusted alternators, and tightened engine belts to keep us rolling along. However, with the automobile quality of the day being what it was, there were some problems even Bruce couldn't fix. One nearly caused a complete breakdown. My father's. In 1974, my father tallied his best year selling commercial lighting fixtures and decided to reward himself. For the first time since my parents started a family, maybe the first time ever as far as any of us knew, Dad allowed himself to purchase a new car. In the past, he'd always bought used vehicles to save dollars for his four kids' college tuitions. But that year, a new model caught his eye. 2 weeks before we were to leave on a spring road trip, he pulled into our driveway, smiling ear to ear, behind the wheel of a gleaming new mustard gold 1974 Oldsmobile Toronado. My father couldn't have been more excited. He called the family out of the house and waved over curious neighbors to have a closer look. Once everyone had assembled, he marched the group in a circle around the car like a tour guide, pointing out every last feature and styling detail. The padded opera roof, the gleaming chrome wheel covers and white wall tires, the elegant front grille that narrowed to a sharp point. Hustling to the driver's side, he cautioned the group to step back as he swung open the massive door and dove into the front seat to demonstrate every switch and button within the driver's reach. The telescoping steering wheel, the six-way adjustable power seat, power windows and door locks, and placed in easy view of the driver an advanced new feature Oldsmobile called the Message Center. This was a matrix of warning lights that kept the driver apprised of every possible mechanical issue, from the oil running too low to the engine temperature climbing too high.
"The car is so smart it can even tell you what's wrong with it," Dad boasted.
Finally, as the climax to his presentation, he turned the ignition. The car's massive 455 cubic inch engine rumbled to life as he pumped the accelerator. The deafening roar raised the eyebrows of everyone within earshot, particularly my mother's. Suddenly sensing his demonstration, heck, his whole choice of car, might have been a bit much, Dad recovered by highlighting what he deemed to be the car's most important feature. The thing that really sold me, of course, was the front-wheel drive. You can't put a price on safe handling, especially with our snowy winters. Of course, kids and parents will disagree on which features should be considered truly important. For me, the coolest aspect of the Toronado was its built-in 8-track tape player. Today, we tend to dismiss the 8-track as a failed novelty of a bygone era, another Betamax. But in its day, the 8-track player wasn't just a tremendous leap forward in entertainment technology. It was dazzlingly popular. The driving force behind the 8-track was Bill Lear of Learjet aircraft fame. Lear became interested in 8-track players because he wanted to incorporate a high-end audio component into his luxury aircraft. However, he quickly realized that the technology could be installed in automobiles as well. After all, the playback units were portable and designed for use in bumpy conditions, and the plastic tapes were durable and easy to change. Lear's break came when he convinced RCA Victor to release its entire catalog on the 8-track format. Next, he persuaded Ford to make the players available as an option for the company's most popular 1966 models, the Mustang, Thunderbird, and select Lincolns. Sales of the players exceeded all expectations, 65,000 units in the first year. That success prompted the introduction of 8-track players for home use, allowing music lovers to swap tapes between their cars and living rooms. By the early 1970s, nearly all domestic automakers offered 8-track players as options, though they were often units installed by dealers beneath dashboards rather than integrated into the instrument panel. By 1974, when my father bought his Toronado, the included 8-track was no longer new technology, but it was new to us. It was also a feature still novel enough for the dealer to throw in two promotional 8-track tapes as an enticing bonus. In our case, these complimentary tapes included a compilation of theme songs from hit TV shows and movies, and a copy of Barry Manilow's latest release. My dad couldn't wait for our vacation to arrive so he'd be able to spend hours behind the wheel of his new Toronado. He knew my mom was skeptical about the wisdom of buying a 2-door coupe for a family of 6. It meant that every time our family traveled together, 3 kids would have to climb over the folding front seats to pile into the back seat. But my father was sure that once my mom experienced the Toronado's silky smooth ride, plush interior, and impressive features, she and the whole family would love the car as much as he did. The first few hundred miles of our trip passed without incident. But as we crossed the Illinois border into Kentucky, the skies turned dark, and raindrops plinked in wide splotches across our windshield. Soon we found ourselves driving through a raging squall. Watching other drivers pull over to seek refuge under overpasses, my mom wondered aloud if we shouldn't do the same. But my father brushed off the suggestion, raving about how well the car's innovative front-wheel drive was handling the wet pavement. With a confident wink to my mom, he crowed, "You know, conditions like this are exactly why I chose this car." The downpour subsided only as we pulled into the parking lot of our motel. Of course, Dad made a point of announcing that the storm had hardly delayed us at all. Thanks to the Toronado's sure handling, we'd made great time and had a couple of hours for swimming and relaxing around the pool. After checking in and conducting our customary reconnaissance,
We returned to the car and formed a semicircle around the trunk to receive our loads. But as my dad turned the key to release the trunk's lid, a cascade of water gushed out, nearly knocking him off his feet. The waterfall splashed to the pavement, soaking our shoes as we looked on in shock. The trunk was a bathtub. Sandals and snorkels and other items bobbed about, tumbling over the sides onto the asphalt. Inside the compartment, our luggage was submerged, and every stitch of clothing we'd brought for the trip was soaked. Our mood, like our clothes, was considerably dampened. Inspecting the trunk, Bruce quickly determined the issue. The foam rubber seal lining the compartment had come loose. No doubt the assembly line worker responsible for its installation, perhaps less than thrilled with management's latest request to work the weekend, had neglected to apply sufficient adhesive to ensure a waterproof barrier. The shoddy seal had allowed a steady leak until rainwater filled the compartment. We never had a clue anything was wrong. Apparently, Oldsmobile's engineers hadn't thought to include a warning light for excess trunk fluid in the Toronado's innovative message center. My father had been looking forward to spending the evening by the pool. Instead, he spent hours bailing to remove the pool that had formed in his new car's trunk. From that point forward, he would never look at the Toronado the same way again. The problem with the trunk, one that would require multiple visits to the dealership to eventually solve, caused him to question the quality of the entire vehicle. Every minor squeak and sputter caused him to wince in fear that it was just the first symptom of some far more serious and costly defect. He finally sold the Toronado for much less than he paid, just so he could sleep at night. He'd owned the car little more than a year. My mom never said a word. She didn't have to. Buying the Toronado had been entirely my dad's decision. She knew he'd beat himself up enough about it without her help. Instead, she went right to wringing out our clothes and loading heap after sopping heap into the two dryers in the motel's tiny laundry room. As I was too young to do anything but get in the way, I was sent off to the game room with a pocketful of quarters, much to my unexpected delight. When I returned to our room hours later, it looked more like the aftermath of an F5 tornado than a 74 Toronado. Damp shirts and pants dangled from curtain rods and coat racks. Soggy socks and nylons were draped over chair backs. Suitcases lay open across every surface. With our pajamas left out to air dry for the evening, my entire family went to bed wearing nothing but our underwear, much to the amusement of my brothers and me, and the utter horror of my sister. In retrospect, though, we'd gotten off lucky, on that occasion and throughout our other years on the road. Our car problems usually resulted in temporary inconveniences or short delays. Not all traveling families were so fortunate. Unlike today, it was common at the time to see motorists stranded by the highway, the hoods of their cars raised like white flags in surrender. Back home, I'd hear stories of classmates whose families were forced to spend their entire vacation in some backwater motel waiting for a new alternator or water pump to arrive, just so they could drive home. If there was one thing about the cars of the 70s you could count on, it's that it was pure folly to count on them at all. It wasn't so much a matter of if things would go wrong with your vehicle, but when. And if, like my family, your vacation depended on countless hours traveling in a car to some distant destination, you were always running on borrowed time. Many children of the era grew up with a very different view of America than their parents did. This was because they spent their childhoods looking at the country backward, from the rear-facing cargo seat of their trusty family station wagon. Considering all the unusual and outlandish vehicles the decade produced, the mighty muscle cars, the shagadelic custom vans, the half-car, half-truck hybrids, it may seem odd that it's the thoroughly square and conventional station wagons that are among the most fondly remembered. But for those of us of a certain age and upbringing, the venerable family station wagon will always hold the prime spot in the cluttered garages of our memories. Nothing epitomized suburban America in the 1970s quite like the station wagon. It was the car owned by the Brady Bunch. The Bradys, like the suburban families they represented, were a two-car family. The father, Mike Brady, drove the showier, sportier vehicle, usually a Chrysler product, always a convertible, and nearly always blue in color. Carol, the mother, was relegated to the station wagon, always the latest Plymouth Satellite. Considering the prevailing chauvinism of the day, it shouldn't be surprising to learn that one of the few times Carol was shown driving the car, she caused a fender bender in a supermarket parking lot and wound up in traffic court. The vehicle that harried moms relied on to cart the kids around to dance classes and baseball games and haul groceries home from the supermarket. And of course, it was the trusty station wagon into which countless parents piled their kids and luggage to make the cross-country trek to Yellowstone National Park or the Grand Canyon. Like most other suburbanites, we owned a station wagon throughout much of the 70s. Only it usually wasn't the car my mom used to run her daily errands. Rather, it was the vehicle my dad used to make sales calls and haul around deliveries for work. Back then, the Rattay family's very un-Brady-like two-vehicle arrangement was for my mom to drive the showpiece car while my dad puttered about in the wagon. But come the weekend when it was time to head to the country club for an evening dinner dance or take to the open road for a long family trip, Dad jumped at the chance to get behind the wheel of his cherished luxury land yachts. We did, however, take a station wagon on a couple of road trips, enough to appreciate the experience so many other families enjoyed. It was almost mandatory for a family to own a Ford Country Squire at some point during the 70s, and we were no exception. Ours was a classic 1972 model, complete with the trademark simulated wood grain side panels, honey-colored bench seats, and patented three-way magic door gate. The magic was that the tailgate could be rotated down and used as a bench or a table for picnics, or it could be swung outward for easy loading of groceries and other cargo. In reality, the most useful aspect of the magic door gate was that it allowed for easy cleaning. Inevitably, it would be showered with the vomit of kids who succumbed to motion sickness from being forced to ride in the side-facing jump seats in the rear. My dad bought the country squire for my mom for the same reasons every other suburban housewife drove one. She almost instantly hated the car. Mom was pint size, and the country squire wasn't. It had a cargo area the size of a football field, and she could barely see out the rear window when backing up. Because mom was constantly backing out of a driveway with small children running around, it was a serious concern. So she swapped cars with my dad, who had no such reservations. He promptly backed out over my new bike, crushing it into a twisted orange pretzel. We took our country squire on only one family road trip, a trek to the Ozarks during Christmas break 1974. It was on this trip that my dad pushed his luck too far with the fuel gauge, and we ran out of gas. The following day, we blew a tire. Not long after returning home, Dad sold the country squire to erase any memory of the whole ordeal. So while many American families traveled the roads of the 70s in a station wagon, mine usually wasn't one of them. Still, it was easy to understand their allure. Most station wagons could seat up to 8 people. At the same time, their gleaming chrome roof racks and spacious cargo areas offered plenty of room for suitcases, sports equipment, and other belongings. Heck, with a rooftop carrier to hold the luggage, a station wagon practically became a living room on wheels. Many models offered all the comforts of home. Carpeted floors, air conditioning, AM/FM stereos, and generously cushioned adjustable seats. And while the large size of station wagons made them hard to navigate around the city, they offered drivers a confident feeling of command out on the limitless stretches of straight highway. In their heyday, station wagons were the cruise ships of the open road. Station wagons had traveled a long way to reach such prominent status. Their origins were far humbler, hinted at in both their name and signature fake wood paneling. As the term implies, The first station wagons were standard automobiles retrofitted with wagon bodies for use around stations. Train stations, to be specific. In the early 20th century, trains were still the most common mode of long-distance transportation by a wide margin. But some sort of conveyance was needed to shuttle train passengers and their loads of bulky baggage between their homes and railroad depots. For taxi services of the day, automobiles were just the ticket. The new contraptions offered a cheaper, more practical alternative to horse-drawn carriages. The problem was that most automobiles were really designed only for transporting passengers, with most manufacturers including just small holds for cargo. Sensing opportunity, a few enterprising souls began purchasing inexpensive Ford Model Ts, then sawing off their steel bodies just behind the windshields. Handymen then built new bodies for the vehicles using hard wood, with seating for passengers in front and long compartments for cargo in the rear. These custom contraptions became known variously as Woodies, Carryalls, Suburbans, Depot Hacks, Hacks was an abbreviation for hackney carriages, and eventually station wagons. Before long, station wagons were popular for all kinds of delivery services. Because creating all-wood bodies was time-consuming, and the market for station wagons was limited, major automakers were initially happy to leave their production to small aftermarket customizers. But as time passed, affluent patrons of taxi services took note of the practical design of station wagons and began ordering their own. As consumer interest in station wagons grew, so did Detroit's interest in making them. Ford was the first major automaker to produce a station wagon. By 1929, the company dominated the market. Other big automakers soon followed Ford's lead. Throughout the 1930s and into the 1940s, station wagons enjoyed a period of remarkable prestige and status. Because their wooden bodies were expensive to fabricate, station wagons were priced much higher than other models, so only the very wealthy could afford them. To compete for these discriminating buyers, station wagon manufacturers crafted increasingly more elaborate wood bodywork for outside the vehicles, while adding luxurious appointments inside. By 1941, Chrysler's Town and Country station wagon was the most expensive vehicle in the company's lineup. In keeping with the vehicle's upscale image, automakers stopped referring to them as station wagons, marketing them instead as estate cars. But the market for such vehicles was limited. In 1940, only one in every 100 vehicles sold in America was a station wagon. That all changed after World War II. Having seen the world while serving in the armed forces, legions of freshly discharged GIs returned home anxious to explore their country, and they wanted to bring their families along. Buyers streamed into dealerships looking for cars not only big enough to accommodate several passengers, but all their luggage too. The impressive station wagons these prospective customers saw on the showroom floor fit the bill. But the cars' hefty price tags didn't fit their budgets. Car makers determined that if they could create a more affordable version of the station wagon, they could open up a whole new market. What's more, production techniques developed during the war had made manufacturing all-steel bodies for station wagons far more practical. By eliminating wood in favor of all-steel bodies, it was possible to produce station wagons that weren't just less expensive, but quieter and easier to maintain. In 1949, Plymouth unveiled the first all-steel station wagon available in the United States, a two-door model called the Suburban. No, Chevrolet didn't later steal the name for its own vehicle. At the time, Suburban was a generic term used to reference any station wagon. In fact, Chevy had marketed its own Suburban in 1935, before Plymouth did. Other major car companies soon introduced their own all-steel station wagons, all of which quickly outsold their more expensive wood-bodied cousins. By 1955, only Ford and Mercury continued to sell Woodies, but these models no longer truly deserved the title. By that time, the once dazzling lacquered all-wood body panels and trim of Ford's Country Squire had already been replaced by the simulated wood grain decals with which it would forever be associated. In reality, the age of the genuine Woody had already passed into history when the last of Buick's Roadmaster estate wagons rolled off the assembly line in 1953. While station wagons constructed of real wood would pass into history, the look wouldn't. Every few years, as trends dictated, imitation wood grain panel decals would reappear on new models to recall the glory days of the wood-bodied station wagons. In the 70s, an era that celebrated all things nylon, Dacron, polyester, and plastic, the notion of incorporating artificial wood into automobile design never seemed more appropriate. Even today, automobile designers often integrate simulated wood grain panels into minivan designs in homage to the classic Woody station wagons. Inexpensive all-steel station wagons proved remarkably popular with families anxious to join America's post-war travel boom. Sales exploded. In 1950, just 3% of cars produced in the United States were station wagons. By the end of the decade, one in every five cars sold was a station wagon. In 1958, Plymouth sold more station wagons than any other body style. With the nation enthralled by the travel possibilities opened by Eisenhower's new interstate highway system, sales of the vehicles soared. By the early 1970s, though, the wild joyride was coming to an end, at least for many full-size station wagons. The OPEC oil crisis and tougher emissions requirements conspired to kill many of the bigger station wagons, just as they strangled the life out of gas-guzzling luxury models and nearly all muscle cars. High gas prices and concerns about the availability of gas in some areas discouraged families from traveling. Those who did mostly stayed closer to home. The heydays of hefty highway cruisers had passed. Sales of domestic full-size station wagons bottomed out in 1974. Not long after, Chrysler, Dodge, and Plymouth halted production of their models. Ford, Buick, and Oldsmobile soldiered on making station wagons, but they were never the same. Shorter, lighter, and comically underpowered, the later model Country Squire and its downsized companions were really just the last of the dinosaurs lumbering along to their inevitable doom. The asteroid that would kill them off appeared in 1984. Called the minivan, it hit the family car market with cataclysmic impact. The first of this new breed of kid hauler to arrive was the Chrysler Town & Country. Models from competitors would quickly follow. From the day they appeared on sales lots, minivans proved so popular that dealers couldn't keep them in stock. Comparing them side by side with hulking station wagons, buyers deemed minivans easier to drive, easier to park, better suited for kids, and far more fuel efficient. Perhaps the biggest obstacle station wagons faced, though, was their wholesome Brady Bunch-inspired image. Baby boomers starting families at the time saw station wagons as the vehicles of their parents' generation. As funny as it may seem today, these young parents viewed minivans as a hip alternative to the square mom-mobiles of the past. Minivans were cool. In the 1990s, after SUVs rumbled into the market to offer young parents another sporty option, the few full-size wagons that remained died off one by one. The venerable Ford Country Squire departed in 1991, followed by the Oldsmobile Custom Cruiser in 1992. Finally, in 1996, the last of the full-size rear-wheel drive wagons, the Buick Roadmaster Estate Wagon and Chevy Caprice Classic Wagon, breathed their last. While a handful of scrappy distant cousins of the great station wagons of the 70s remain today, these vehicles as a species have all but vanished from our roads. But for those of us who spent countless hours of our childhoods queasily staring the wrong way down the highway, station wagons will be remembered for far more than fake wood paneling. They'll be remembered as the vehicles that led us on many genuinely fun adventures. Chapter 10. Through the Windshield Together. A crash course in seatbelts and safety. Maybe the reason they built cars so much bigger in the 70s was because those of us who traveled in them had so much more freedom to revel in